Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 714. Today's Friday, the 7th of August.
It is.
This podcast is going up. I'm going to be performing in Orlando tonight and Tampa tomorrow night and then Northern California next weekend on the Fun Comfortable Tour. What else you got on the Nerds Community Corkboard?
I got one. They've sent it a couple times. I'm excited to finally get this shout out. It's a show called the Dirty Talk Game Show. It's in San Francisco at the Oasis. They're doing their third one on August 11th. You can go to dirtytalkgameshow.com. Chris, how would you like to do a game show where in front of a room full of kind of drunk people, you have to compete against other funny people for how well you can dirty talk to an audience?
Oh my God.
Uncomfortable. Go to the website. It's amazing.
I would sweep that competition. I was having dinner last night at this place called Mud Hen Tavern.
Already dirty.
And it's really good, actually. Mud Hen Tavern is really good. But where I could sitting, I could see the bar, and there was a baseball game on, and people were cheering, and I'm like, God damn sports. Like, I got all cranky about it.
What's wrong with sports?
Shut up. So we're leaving.
Denied.
So we're leaving, and a bunch of people look at me really weird. And I'm like, what? And the friend of mine I was having dinner with knew one of the people at the table. And they go, it was completely opposite of what I thought. They go, this is Geeks Who Drink. And you were just an answer and a question. And I'm like, it was not only was it the diametrical opposite of the thing I thought it was. They were all cheering because of trivia night. But I was an answer and a question, and I said, I am so sorry I didn't know or hear that, because I could have run in and I could have just dashed into the room and gone, I have been summoned, which would have been amazing.
And no one would have believed their drunken story.
No.
Yeah, it turns out Chris Hardwick's like Candyman. If you just say his name in the mirror, he shows up. Then you have to run a panel in your bathroom.
What do you got on the corkboard?
I want to remind people to listen to some of the other shows we have on the network. For example, Today We Learned recently had Jerry Ferrara, who plays Turtle in Entourage, on the show. Nerdist Writers Panel had a lot of the writers from Halt and Catch Fire. On this week's You Made It Weird, Pete talked to Dan Harmon. So that got super weird.
Did they make it weird?
Of course they made it weird.
Okay, good.
Well, it's Harmon.
I would hope so, yeah. But I also, since today is Friday, last night was Jon Stewart's last Daily Show.
Aww.
Which is, we're recording this intro the day before. So we haven't seen the last episode yet, but it is the end of an era with that man. And I don't really know John that well, but have been inspired by him. And, you know, he helped give me a public intervention in the year 2000 on his show, where he kind of made fun of me for being a loser because I wasn't working. And it actually was one of the things that got me to like, oh, maybe I should get my shit together. I think he just meant it as a joke, but
it really stuck.
It stuck. And so I have to personally thank John for that, and also just being a force in comedy and being a force in politics and being just being that entity for 17 years.
It's going to be a weird world moving forward without
this. It's, you know, it's sort of like a dot when you lose a doctor and you get a new doctor.
Yeah.
You know, Trevor's coming in. I don't know. I haven't met Trevor yet, but I'm sure we will soon. But, you know, he'll have a different show, and then I'm sure at first people are like, well, it's not John. And then sooner they'll be like, oh, okay, well, this is a different.
I imagine there's one guy who was like, it's not Craig Kilborn.
Still, bring back Kilborn. I was on the Kilborn train, then you replace him with John Stewart. Then you put him on another name, then you replace him with Craig Ferguson.
I missed the don't go there segment.
Come on.
That's some vintage Daily Show jokes.
But in any case, huge, bowing to you, John Stewart. And your comedy supremacy, and congratulations on 17 incredible
That's
years.
Insane.
I know.
There's a high school senior who's only been alive through The Daily Show.
Yeah, like the first episode of The Daily Show, some guy was being born. Some DNA was being shot into a lady, and then now 17 years later, that
I like you said episode, they have like a winter or a spring birthday.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, in any case, that's it's odd and it's weird and it's the end of an era.
It hasn't sunk in for me yet. It's going to be weird.
It will.
I don't like it.
It's much more sort of in my face because I'm in that block of programming. So,
That's going to be so weird.
Yeah, I know. Wow. So we did the show last night.
You're the lead in for stuff.
Not really. We're still on at midnight. We're the lead in for South Park reruns, I guess.
You go.
I don't know. But this episode is Kevin Bacon. This is the second time on the podcast. We got Kevin Bacon on the podcast twice. And he was fantastic. Oh, my God. Kevin Bacon. And he said I could come hang out with him.
Yeah, you got to go do that.
I think he was just saying that to be nice.
But I'm going to
make him, I'm going to make him regret throwing that offer out there.
He opens that door,
he's
going to be like, ready to bro down, bro?
You bro. You said bro. Come on, bro. Come on, broken.
Just, yeah.
Kevin broken. No, no, that doesn't really work that way. That becomes another word.
It becomes another word.
Cop Car is the movie he's promoting. It is in theaters Friday, August 7th, on demand August 14th, which you should totally look up the movie because he describes in the podcast. And it, he what?
He plays the car.
He does not play the car.
Oh, I must miss that.
You're thinking of My Mother, the
car. That's exactly what I'm thinking of. Yeah. I get those confused all the time.
I get these old 50s old sitcoms.
Old James L. Brooks projects and Kevin Bacon's recent films are things I confuse all the time.
But those are old sitcoms from the 50s. Like, that goes back even farther.
James L. Brooks wrote for it, though.
He wrote on My Mother,
the car.
In the 50s?
In the 60s, I guess.
Touché.
But yeah, Ken Keeler's really big on pushing that anytime.
Maybe you should go to Geeks Who Drink Trivia Night.
I probably should.
All right.
James L. Brooks was just on Nerdist Writers Panel.
What? He was with Phil Rosenthal.
Yep.
What?
Yep.
Oh, I got to go listen to this and all the other fine Nerdist podcasts on the network.
I should have printed that one earlier, too.
But again, Cop Car, in theaters Friday, August 7th, on demand, August 14th.
Ow.
Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 714 with Mr. Kevin Bacon.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Do you have dogs?
I do, yeah. I was just talking about my dog, Lily, who's... street rescue dog. And then out here, my daughter has a dog that is my grand dog, Rocky. And now she's also spending a lot of time with her boyfriend's dog. So they're two giant, black dogs. One's a lab and the other is what most people would think would be a pit, but he's actually a Staffordshire Terrier.
Mm-hmm. Do you... not get to see your dogs for long periods of time?
No, I bring Lily pretty much most places.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
I don't fly her because I don't like her being flown, but if I'm in one place at one time, I get a dog transport. I have this incredibly expensive dog transport system that drives her to wherever I am.
That's really nice.
So she's either usually with me or with Kira.
Yeah, I mean, it's the... the whole thing about traveling dogs and, I don't know if it's – I don't think it's safe to put them in the hull of the plane. I mean, it's
– I used to do it probably two dogs ago and, but it's rough. It's rough on them. You can see they get off and they're like all, shaking and freaking out and, and the planes now have all rules that they didn't used to have. But if there's a temperature – at which the tarmac has to be at the place where you are landing. And if the temperature is above that or is estimated to go above that or below a certain temperature, they won't let you put the dog on the flight. So you can get to the airport and it's kind of a crapshoot. And they can also refuse pit bulls. So that's another issue.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's tough. It's tough to travel dogs.
Well, in the old days, all the dogs were just smoking on the plane, and there was no
playing cards with their
just
feet.
Playing. Dogs didn't have to go through security. You could just go. You could just walk right on.
Those
were the days. Back in the old days.
Yeah,
I think I don't know if you remember being on the podcast the last time because it was a couple years ago, and I think
sure.
We came out to you in New York.
Yeah, we were in the trailer. Yeah.
You were in the trailer, and I think you would the following hadn't premiered yet.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think it had just started. I mean, we were just kind of starting it.
So okay.
It was a few years ago.
Yeah, a few years ago, yeah.
Your Free the Bacon video was fucking amazing.
Thank you.
and also, I don't know, you kind of, I have a lot of respect for if you're sort of poking fun at the fact that the show got canceled, like, which is a good attitude to have. Like, it's a fun, healthy attitude.
I've been doing this so long that it's a funny thing. I think honestly, when you do movies and you keep doing movies, you go through the experience of something not working at the box office again and again and again. So it's something you get a thick skin for. It's not you can't you can't hang your entire life on the success or failure of something you're involved with. Otherwise, you just stop, or you'll, you know, go off the rails or whatever. So, you know, the following three seasons, you could make the argument that that's pretty good, three seasons, to get three seasons out of something these days.
I think it's amazing to get three episodes out of something on television.
No, it's true. It's true. And I enjoyed it when I was doing it, and, you know, learned a lot. And so it was definitely sad to say goodbye to the crew. I know people say that a lot, but it really is true. And to the rest of the cast, you know, we did have a really, really strong bond. So that was the saddest part.
Do you feel at this point like, you know, I'm probably going to be okay? Something will come along. It's not a big deal. I've already got a thing in the works. Like, or do you still feel the actor thing of like, oh no, this is ending. What's going to happen?
No, I still feel the actor thing. I do. But I can tell you that for the first time when The Following ended, I was not in a rush to book the next gig. And that's something that was kind of unusual for me. Usually I'm kind of like, I gotta get it going. But since it was like 3 years of you know, being on the same show, for some reason I was like, okay, let me just stop and think about where it is that I want to go. And it's interesting because once I opened up the idea of television, there's a lot of possibilities, you know. There's a lot of possibilities of either going into something that's, you know, half an hour, let's say, and comedic, or developing something, or doing a limited series, or working on a play, or directing. You know, I mean, I got a lot of sort of possibilities. So I'm just trying to figure it out right now.
And at least with television, you can go, you know, I would like to be in New York for a while, so maybe I can find something that's there, and you know that you kind of that you get to be there and not have to be as nomadic for a while.
Yeah, I wish I did that. I mean, I don't know. I don't start with that, because I think then you are kind of, well, look, on The Following, they gave me a choice of New York and LA, and I said I wanted to, you know, be in New York. So that was a great, you know, luxury. But a lot of times, you know, you don't really have that luxury. You know, it takes place in wherever, the desert, or, you know, a, you know, European town or something like that. You know, you're SOL if you wanted to shoot it in New York.
Do you think having a, since your daughter is also an actor, mm-hmm. and I'm sure she probably learned a lot what the business must be like from the perspective of having but her parents in the business, but did you ever have the same sit-down talk that you would have with kids about sexuality, but about acting, like, okay, here's some of the birds and the bees of this business, and try not to take this too seriously and deal with that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because both of my kids are very independent kids, and neither one of my kids, we didn't shove our business or our industry or our work really into their faces. If you ask them, I think they've only probably seen a handful of my movies or Kira's movies. And they, up until the point when my daughter decided to be an actress, hadn't really shown an interest in that part of show business. My son is a musician. He has been since he was a kid, and I'm a musician. So that was kind of a natural thing. And we have, as he's gotten older, I mean, I can't teach him anything about music because he really got better. He's a better guitar player than me by the time he was about 13, honestly.
Oh, wow.
So that wasn't anything, you know, that, you know, I mean, he teaches me. But we do talk about music. We talk about production. We talk about gigs. We talk about, you know, just stuff around music, because I know it from touring with a band and all that kind of stuff. So that's really fun to have that kind of conversation. With my daughter, all of a sudden now, once she decided that this is what she wanted to do, we can have a dialogue about this life that Kira and I have made for ourselves. And it's kind of great, because I didn't know that I would ever have those kinds of conversations with one of my offspring, and say, you know, or she can generally say, you know, what do you do when you're at an audition and, you know, blah, blah, blah happens? Or have you ever had a moment where you got one take and you loved it, and then they had to go again because of a technical issue, and you feel like you're not there? And you know what I mean? All these kinds of things that I just never really thought we'd be in a position to share, or now something that we can share. And that's great. And she's also, she's different than me in that she is a little bit more of an open book around these things. You know, when I was a kid, when I became an actor, I didn't come from a theatrical family. And, you know, I didn't want advice or mentorship or guidance from anyone. And I think you do yourself a disservice, you know. I mean, I felt like I knew everything. I didn't want agents to tell me anything, managers to tell me anything. I was even sort of, I think in some ways, I threw myself into every film role and every acting role and everything with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and desire to make it the best it could possibly be. And I really worked hard and really did my homework and all that. But I can't say that I put myself in the hands of a director like, oh, please, please mold me. I was always, you know, kind of either resistant or disappointed in the kind of direction or the support that I was getting. And I think that that's really a mistake, certainly on the mentorship side of things. People have asked me, you know, in sort of interviews, you know, well, who was your mentor and did anybody guide you and what was the great advice you got? I got nothing.
Sounds like it was just trial and error.
It was learn by mistakes and learn by doing.
I mean, it's kind of nice. I mean, it sounds nice that all these moments, which you probably didn't even realize you were storing, now you can sort of take out of your mental attic and go, oh, these have value because someone else is asking me about these. When did you ever think you'd be able to go, oh, well, during a take, if this happens, like that you would be able to be able to basically pass that information on to someone?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think I would. And I certainly didn't think I would pass it on to a child of mine. So it's great. It's great. And also, you know, she's kind of discovering old work of ours and, you know, saying, oh, you know what, I watched, you know, whatever. And that was kind of cool, you know.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. That's great. It's great.
And it's also cool that you didn't pressure your kids. You're going to sit down. There's going to be a bacon marathon this weekend.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
A Cedric marathon next weekend. Yes. And you're going to see what we... Because I can understand it must be difficult to... I don't have kids, but I know... Even just meeting young people now, like people in their early 20s, sometimes I feel like, oh, we're not communicating on the same. And no matter what you try to do to bond with them or try to like, hey, it just feels like they're a little closed off. So, you know, being able to have those conversations, particularly with your kids, who sometimes I think look at their parents as like, yeah, you parents don't know shit.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think that gets a little better in your 20s. I think that once the kids are in their 20s, that's been my experience, is that teens are really at that, you know, kind of like my parents are idiots, you know, stage. And when they get into their 20s and they become adults and they start to go, well, look, you know, things like I need to rent an apartment, you know, I need to have a bank account, I need to, you know, I don't know, just stuff like that, like the day to day life of kind of trying to support yourself. You can finally kind of get in there and say, "No, let me give you some advice, Eric."
I feel like life is basically a breadcrumb trail to understanding my parents. Where it's just like the older I get, you know, like all the things that I thought they did when I was younger that I thought were stupid. As you get older, you're like, oh, that's why. Okay. Oh, well, that makes sense. Of course they, you know, I just wasn't getting the full story.
Yeah. I was thinking about that in terms of like acting class, because I got into acting class when I was about 17 or 18. I went to Circle in the Square and we had a few different acting teachers, and some of the exercises and the things that we would do, I just did not get them. They just seemed... they seemed like a waste of time to me, you know. Again, it was that kind of thing of I don't need to be taught this, you know, I can do this, you know, kind of cockiness that I had. And there are a lot of those lessons that are now, even now, sort of coming back full circle. And I'm like, oh, I get it. I get it. I get it. I'll give you an example. We used to do an exercise. I had a class that was based on the Lee Strasberg, you know, / Stanislavski kind of method, what we call the method. And one of the exercises that's very popular in the method is something called a private moment. And basically, you would come into class and you would set up your apartment or some kind of living space. It could be your home or your apartment that you lived in now. And the class would watch you sit there and live there. And it's not really, it's supposed to be not really a performance. It's just supposed to be you living there. It could be up to 15, 20 minutes, I mean, which can be like excruciatingly boring. And you're getting to a point where you do something that you would stop if somebody else walked into the room. So in other words, a private moment. And, you know, for us, it was mostly about sitting there hoping that some of the female students would be getting naked.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And, or somebody would be doing something that would be like, in, you know, outrageous and, you know, embarrassing in some kind of a way. And I didn't understand it. I was like, this is just seems like a waste of time. As of, what I've really come to learn is that when it comes to insight into character, private moments can be incredibly powerful. You know, you think about a character who walks into a room and does something alone, you know, it, and you're able to witness it, you know, in a kind of almost like voyeuristic sort of way. It can be a real, real insight into it. I think about amazing movie that Coppola directed called The Conversation. And at the end of the conversation, he sits there, you know, Gene Hackman's character takes out a saxophone and just plays this saxophone. And it's just so cool. It's so interesting. And it's a way of learning about a character without the character actually opening his mouth and saying anything or talking about himself.
I play the saxophone.
yeah, exactly. And so it's things like that that have kind of made sense. But it takes a long time to figure out why, you know, once they're kind of laid in your brain.
Well, also I would guess trying to break down the barrier between, I am consciously in front of a group of people and I'm supposed to be having a private moment. What type of a private moment? It's like getting out of your head and just being in a moment as opposed to figuring out how to do the moment.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Acting it. Yeah. And I would sit there and it was very hard for me to do that. You know, it was very hard for me. And I'd sit there going, oh, this is taking too long. It's too boring. When do I get to it? You know, what's it going to be? And is it going to be something that is going to be embarrassing, or am I truly approaching this exercise with complete honesty, or am I tempering something that I hope will be a performance? So it's an interesting exercise.
I think most people are actually just incredibly boring in their private moments.
yeah, and that in itself is something. You know, that in itself is something to say. Well, do I have to? Do I have to reach for it to be interesting all the time? You know, I think there is a balance there between, you know, truly staying to the truth of a character, which is not always interesting. People aren't always interesting. Or infusing moments with something that we more traditionally would think of as a performance. And I think that sometimes reaching that balance is our actors that we find very compelling. I mean, I know for instance that, you know, when I always say to young actors that to me, it's a lot more interesting to watch a documentary when you're researching a part or trying to find a character as opposed to watching another performance from another actor. Because, you know, real people are oftentimes, you know, intensely fascinating. I mean, you know, you look at a close up of, you know, Robert Durst and you know, how do you, I mean, I play plenty of sociopaths, but how do you get to that? You know, how do you get to that?
Yeah, there's just fucked up wiring from the get go there. I can imagine being an actor and then just like going back every 3 seconds and just taking notes.
Yeah,
you know, like
for
that.
Sure,
there's nothing that just that moment of like just the involuntary, you know, throwing up thing.
Right, right.
That's it, like if you saw that in a movie, you'd be like, "What an amazing choice!"
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
That's just one of those things that you just need to see to go, "Oh, when your body is trying to protect something so hard, and literally it just starts bursting at the seams. It's right. going to have a physical, there's going to be like a weird physical manifestation.
Right.
Yeah. I wondered if there was a mad rush the day after that of just all these A-list actors like, I want to play Durst. I want to play the all fucking right. character.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's almost a tough row to hoe because he played it so well in the documentary. You know, we've seen so much of him, you know. You'd have to – well, they already did it actually, didn't they?
It was because of that that he agreed to – and then in you know, when Durst was in acting class, his private moment was space work killing three women and then just picking up the phone and going, I don't know. That was his private moment. I was in one of this idea of private moments is really interesting because this might be too arty of a question, but does that translate to music at all? And the reason that I ask is because – I think when you're doing something musically at home by yourself, you're more apt to take risks or try things as opposed to when you're in front of people, you might, you know, play it a little safer because you're being watched.
Definitely, definitely. You know, I haven't done – when I first started writing songs, I would kind of write them melodies and lyrics in my head, and then I would bring them to my brother. I didn't have an instrument, and I you know, would just have these, you know, ideas. And sometimes they were fairly well constructed, but I wasn't actually playing them. And he would figure out the changes and would sometimes sort of rearrange things, maybe add a bridge or help with, you know, kind of lyrical thing. And then we started writing a couple of songs together. And pretty quickly, I stepped out and started writing completely by myself. And yes, I don't usually like to have anybody around, even within earshot. Because it's so much trial and error, and it's so much about, you know, kind of fucking up and hear it, listening it, you know, or playing it back and going, oh, and then dropping the guitar and coming back to it and picking it up and trying it another way. And so that is my experience. It's a very private thing, writing a song, to the extent that the first time I play it for Kira, usually my heart is kind of pounding and I'm you know, kind of struggling over the changes and it's a very vulnerable kind of place to take that very, very private thing and just put it out there for the first time for somebody else to, dissect. We recently, something that we've done hardly at all, went into a situation with a young songwriter, and you sit down in a room in a hotel. This is a hotel room in Nashville, and try to come up with a song together. And that's the way a lot of songs are written now. They really are quite often written by committee, partly because a lot of times artists want to share in the songwriting. You know, it makes financial sense.
Sure.
Also, you know, some people are just delivering tracks and structure of song, and then, you know, someone who is good with lyric and melody will just kind of put the track on top of the lyric and a melody up right on top of a track. But this, in its own way, is a big adjustment from being a lone songwriter, because there you're going, you know, what if it is, you know, her eyes were green, the best I've ever seen, and everyone goes,
yeah, you know what I mean? Should we it's throw like, our hands in the air and wave around like we just don't care? Come on, what are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a funny. It was a. We'll see. I mean, I think the song's kind of cool, and I, but it was definitely a. I realized when I was done with that experience, because it was probably about, I don't know, three four hours. We were in this, you know, small hotel room, and that it was emotionally and creatively kind of like exhausting because I wasn't used to it. You know, it's not something I'd done before.
Do you feel like some of that when you were younger, that personality of like, no, I know what I'm doing. Do you feel like that carried over to music as well? That's just part of the whole thing.
I think that in music, I was probably smart enough to know that at that point that I needed, you know, help. I mean, I needed teachers, and I needed to have the experience of the musicians around me to sort of to walk me through it, you know, and help me through it. I was smart enough to know that with music, but not so much with acting.
I think this question is, I think, going to be very helpful if you can shed some light on it, because you have a incredibly successful relationship. But the whole idea of creative people, like when you said, also, you know, I'll play a song for her for the first time.
when you're in that vulnerable position, it can be weird for the other person not knowing exactly how they're supposed to react. Like, oh, if I – it's great. Oh, well, you didn't mean – you know, you kind of went, you know, where, because you're insecure and vulnerable because you're putting yourself out there and you're reading everything, you know. So is there good advice for how to properly listen to or properly give feedback, you know, even if the feedback might be negative sometimes?
Yeah. No, it's tough. It's tough. I don't know. I mean, I guess you have to, obviously, you know, you have to be respectful. And I think my brother and I, you know, also have this kind of thing because he plays me songs of his and I have to play him songs of mine too. So we have to share those and see if they're going to be something that we're going to take to the band, you know. And I think our attitude is if you made it through the process of writing a song, let's keep, you know, let's not flush it just based on one listening, you know. Let's keep saying, well, have you can you transpose it up a step and see if it takes your voice in a different place, or I like it, but it just seems kind of dirge like that tempo, you know. Well, you know, things like that that you can say, well, let's keep shaping it and figuring it out. You know, I wrote a song about a giant squid, and it's partly about the squid, it's partly about my father passing away, and partly about the nature of celebrity, if you can fit all those things into a song.
Yes.
And the point is that I wrote it, you know, it was kind of like a folky, basically, you know, just kind of like acoustic sort of ditty. And my brother envisioned it more as a kind of fat Celtic sort of vibe. And it's not something that I had ever heard in my construction of this song, and you know, wrote this kind of melody around it. And when we do it now live, the essence of that is there, but the vibe of the song is nothing that I had ever dreamed of. So he could kind of say, it's fine. It's like the bones of it are there, or you could sort of push it into a direction that is. You know, now I think is really powerful and people really like. So you have to. I don't think you can just. The answer to your question is, I don't think it's worth it to shut it down right away. And I think that the other thing is that you know sometimes that over time, as you put things out there, you can start to sense whether or not they're worth continuing to pursue.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing with like, you know, performances and movies and choices, you know, in acting or whatever. You know, you start to put something out there and you learn a lot from that.
Yeah, but I think there are some people though that almost feel a little nervous if their significant other says, "Hey, I made this thing. What do you think?" Because they know, like, "Oh fuck, there's no right answer." Right. Even if I say it's great, they're gonna go, "Oh, you're just saying that."
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I know it is. It's risky. I don't know. Somehow we've figured out the way to kind of navigate that.
Did your brother know that the song was also sort of a metaphor for the – he didn't know?
No, I don't think he knew. No, in fact, I bet you – I've been in situations where we've been on stage and I've introduced a song and said, you know, this is kind of about this. And he turns over and goes, "What? You're kidding me. I had no fucking idea this was that much." Really? Or in interviews or something? Yeah. No, I don't think he knew. I don't tend to explain it before I sing it to him. So
right.
We do sometimes live because I think it's kind of nice to set a song up and people sort of like that, but not in the first singing it.
How long ago, when did you lose your dad?
Probably maybe 10 years.
Oh, it's been 10 years now?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's, I'm just shy of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said, yeah, it takes about 2 years before you just feel totally okay.
Mm-hmm. How'd they come up with that number?
I don't know. They just sort of felt like, you know, like not totally okay.
I Googled it and you only need 2 years.
On the exact 24 months, you're like, hey, it's fine. It's all fine now.
Yeah.
I mean, is it something that you feel sort of bleeds in here and there? Does it kind of never go away? Is it always, you know, is it always just out there? Do you think about it sometimes?
I don't really think about it. too much. I think about him every once in a while, but I don't. Both of my parents are gone, and it's not something that that preoccupies me on a daily basis. Certainly, it is a powerful moment when you're an orphan. You know, it definitely is a powerful moment.
Sure,
I mean I think it's as powerful as having a, you know, having a child in some ways. You know, when you say, okay, now I'm, you know, I really am on my own,
and you're sort of the head of the whole thing now.
Yeah,
it's like you're. Yeah. Oh wait, no, there was always someone up here. Oh no, now I'm the statesman who's supposed to have all the answers.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
But do you
got to get my shit together?
But it sounds like though, part of your personality has always been like, no, I, you know, I can figure this out. I don't need, I'm good. I don't need to, you know, I can do this shit.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, speaking of my parents, I mean, I think that's a message that me and most of my siblings got, you know, or if not all of us. My wife often talks about that, you know, it's such a Bacon thing that you don't need, you just go out and you do. And being the youngest of six, I think that, and this is not in any way an indictment of them. I mean, I think they were very supportive, loving parents, but they did not have any part of them that was trying to kind of hold on. You know, I think they really, especially me. I often joke that, you know, when I left home, they didn't notice I was gone. You know? that's really in some ways true. You know, they. And we didn't have the kind of relationship when we were talking about my kids earlier, where I went to them for advice or I asked for, you know, permission to do things. So it's nice on my end when with my children I actually can have that, you know, because I don't know if they missed that or whatever, but I think maybe I kind of missed it.
Yeah. And so you're getting to kind of re-express that, but from the other side.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is good.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I mean, do you think, do you see, well, your kids are still, they're in their early 20s, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you might be a ways off from grandkids.
I think so. I'd like to think so. I have grand dogs, but I'm
that's good for now.
Yeah, it's good for now. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Some parts of me feel like, oh, I'm kind of glad I didn't have kids when I was young because it really allowed me to figure out who I was, and I was a mess when I was young and I would have been a shitty parent.
Do you have kids now?
I don't. Mm-hmm. So, and other parts of me are like, God, now if I have a kid now, I'm going to be super old by the time they're in high school, and that just feels like... I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know. I think I'm better to be a parent now, but in some cases I'm like, I don't want my kids to be like, you know, that's not my grandfather, that's my dad. And just so you know, I was not an accident. He chose to have kids older.
My brother-in-law just had a baby at 50 and he's thrilled.
Oh, really?
And they're incredibly close and he's a great dad. And you know, he always kind of knew he would be. But it's a joy.
It makes
joy.
Me feel a lot better.
Yeah, he's doing great.
You can all, as long as you can point to someone who's a little bit older and go, okay, this guy, I have this one example. That's all I need.
Yeah,
as long as I know one guy did it, then I'm probably okay.
Yeah, I mean, we were happy and, you know, probably crazy, but we were happy to get it done. You know, but that was just our road. You know, that's the way it worked.
Yeah. Are you on any kind of, I assume you're probably doing press tours pretty heavily for Cop Car right now.
Yeah.
Were you going to take a break after that or are you immediately jumping onto something else?
I don't know yet. You know, I'm looking at a few things. I'm trying to think when I finished the following. It's been a while and I don't think I've done something since I rapped. So this has actually been for me, a pretty long time off. But I'm starting to feel like, you know, now that the Cop Car press is sort of almost over, that, you know, I'm ready to go back to work.
Do you ever have to audition for anything anymore at this point?
I haven't auditioned in a really, really long time. And that's not to say that I wouldn't, but I do kind of feel like, you know, how can I put this? I mean, I think that I think it's a two-way process, right? Because a director's got to figure out if I'm right for a part, and I got to figure out if the director is right for the movie and for me, and if the part is right for me. And one of the first criteria of a director that I want to work with is someone that knows that they want to work with me.
Right.
So I don't know. It hasn't even come up, honestly, for probably, wow, I mean, many, many years, 30 years or something.
I mean, I'm not surprised in the least, but I also wonder at some point, is it good to mix it up and just do that stuff again just to remind yourself, yes, like, oh, I can still, I got to know how to do that.
I think it is, and I can tell you, I recently went in and was in a situation of trying to get a directing gig. And, all of a sudden I was on my way to the meeting and I went, wow, this is really like, this is an audition, because I got to come in and, pitch an idea for the way I see the movie and the types of changes that I might want to make and the visual aspect of it. And it really was like an audition. So I do think it's good. And to get past that was a feeling that was, dangerous and then sort of exhilarating, just to get on the other side of that. I often go out with projects to develop, and you go out and you pitch something to a network or a studio. That in its own way feels a little bit like an audition. You know what I mean? It's like everyone comes in, there's small talk, and then everyone gets a bottle of water.
There's a weird pause.
Too much water. And then it's like, okay, so what do you got? And and you're like, okay, here's the thing. It is that thing of like kind of being on and doing your thing. Like I said, if something came up that somebody really felt like they just, for whatever reason wanted to, see what I look like with a hump or, whatever it was. I'm not opposed to it, but it honestly hasn't come up. It's not like it's been, I at least as far as I know, unless my, representatives, it's not like I get auditions and turn them down.
Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, I think at a certain point, it's sort of like, well, you probably know what I can do, so do you want that or do you not want that? Mm-hmm. Rather than going full process. But I do, sometimes I wonder, with stand-up, should I go back and just do some open mics again? Because it's unfamiliar at this point, and you can get too comfortable, So is it good to just to go back and try to mix it up at a basic level?
Well, I think you hit on something that I think is really true, and that is that I do believe that it's good to have a little bit of danger in your creative life, that or maybe even in your life in general. I mean, I don't jump out of planes or anything, but I think that, that's sort of, certainly when for the first probably 10, 15 years of being in a band, and still to this day, you get up to the edge of the stage and, you're starting to wait and the lights are going down. And there's an element of anything can happen. You can forget a lyric, break a string, heckler, and there's a lot of ways that one night can kind of be a disaster that you may have to sort of overcome. I've never fallen off the stage and broken my leg and then come back on stage and finish the show.
That's pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing.
Nice job, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. I think that having a little bit of danger in your creative life, and I used to feel that way about theater. I mean, the band in some ways kind of took over that part of my live experience, but you, it's that night is a night that you're going to share with that people, and there's a certain electric kind of risk there that I think is important. A movie set to me now is a very, very comfortable place to be. It doesn't hold it's like a recording studio. It's usually a pretty controlled environment. you know, I mean, strapping yourself to a plane, notwithstanding, you know.
Nice job, Tom.
Yeah, you know, I just have to give props to those people that do, you know, really take the risks.
He's really like every time upping it. Like, I don't know what the fuck is it.
What's next?
Tom Cruise lived on a hot air balloon for 300 days. Jesus Christ, Tom. We get it. The most spry 50-year-old in the world.
All right. So we'll see. I mean, I think that the idea of going back and grabbing a mic, which, by the way, I have to say, I think in the world of show business, could be one of the most frightening things that an entertainer can do. It would be stand up. I would think.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, just because you don't even have the guitar.
You're responsible for everything. That's what's so fun about it, is that you control the entire experience and you sort of live or die by it.
Talking about the die, but the die part. And I've seen it. You know, I've spent a lot of time in comedy clubs and because I like it and I enjoy it. And I think to myself, holy shit, that's scary. I mean, to just get up there and shit the bed just seems it feels like a really big risk.
Well, it is an emotional risk, but everyone does it. Everyone bombs, and of course you hate yourself, and you're like, you could have 10 amazing shows and one bomb show, and then you're like, I'm clearly not doing the right thing in life. But you know, but then you, once you get past that, it's just like anything. Like once you, I guess in my head I thought I was just going to die and the world was going to cease to exist. But it turns out the sun is still in the air and everything's fine. And, you know, and then but I think whether or not you know whether you should do stand up is, if you have a horrible bomb and you go, well, I'm never doing this again, you probably shouldn't be a stand up. But if you go, but I have to do it, I need to do it again.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I think that's how you know that you're probably doing.
Oh, that's true.
The
that's
right
a pretty
thing.
Good test. Yeah.
It's a compulsion. Yeah. You know, because I watch musicians and I watch guitar players and I go, oh, I could never. I mean, like, that just seems horrifying to me to have to be technically proficient in that way at exactly the right time and not fuck it up. You know, like that. Watching live music, I feel that kind of anxiety watching live music.
Interesting.
But I'm sure to you, it just feels like, man, I don't know, it's something I do.
Yeah, I mean, now it does, actually. You know, but, you know, I mean, if I play – well, let me put it this way. It's nice to have a band.
Yeah.
You know, you know. I mean, you know, solo acoustic is definitely a challenge.
You got to do the Prince thing. If you fuck up something, do it again so people think it was intentional.
Yeah, do it twice.
You got to do it twice.
Yeah.
Did the music part unlock things that helped inform? Because I think the idea of kind of interdisciplinary study is really good. Because I think, you know, one thing can give you perspective on something, on the other thing that you thought you already completely understood. So did the two help inform each other or unlock things on either side?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of songs that I've written in trailers on sets of movies. I think partly because, not so much on The Following, because it was, you know, like such a crazy schedule, but partly because of the time spent in the trailer. That's one thing that I have, is a guitar and sometimes a, you know, laptop to have a little kind of studio situation. But also because you are creatively kind of open, on edge, and you know, available for something to come through you. So there's that kind of crossover. I also find that when it comes to singing a lyric in the studio or live, if I've kind of lost track of what the song was about, you know, or if I've just kind of, if I start singing it by rote or I've put it out of my mind, then I tend to just not really sing it that well. And once I go back and I say, wait a second, you know, this is a song about, you know, joy or heartbreak or the road or whatever it is, you know, you can, the performance takes a step up. And that to me is kind of an acting exercise.
Yeah.
You know? Because, you know, as an actor, for instance, if you're doing a piece of theater and you keep doing it night after night after night, and you start losing some kind of a moment, and you start going, well, you know, I don't know, it's just not working as well. The audience, there used to be a laugh there, but it went away, and the audience doesn't seem to be getting it or whatever. I'm not feeling it. It's probably because you kind of forgot what it was about. You're just going like by rote.
Yeah.
You know, you're repeating yourself. So you have to always sort of be going back to some kind of an emotional connection. So they do overlap in that way. You know, in terms of like opening something up, I'm not sure. And I tend to creatively also, you know, I kind of put on my kind of music mind, and then I take that off and start to think more like an actor. And people have often said, well, why don't you combine the two and do something, do a kind of movie that's music related, or, you know, which is not, I'm not opposed to, but it, I also don't want to fit a square peg in a round hole. You know, the choices that I make as an actor are important to me, and it's not going to make it more interesting to me if I get to, you know, play and sing.
Right. So you're not trying to sandwich it into.
I'm not.
So in A Few Good Men, could he like riff on a guitar? You know, I don't know if this is really right for this character.
Right. Right.
Or, no, but he could be good.
Or worse, if I was pitching that idea.
Yeah, you're pitching that idea. Yeah. You just, you know what? I brought the guitar. If you want to me to shoot a scene with it, just to have it.
Right. The guy on the following is like secretly a great songwriter. Yeah.
At the very end, he just pulls out the guitar, sort of like the conversation. But there is an acting, but it's that live performance thing, because it's sort of like if you say a word over and over and over and over again, it completely loses meaning, and you're just making sounds.
Yeah.
And there's a real skill, I think, in being able to make something sound fresh or new. I mean, can you imagine just, you know, being a band, not that they tour together anymore, but being a band like the Eagles, where it's like, okay, guys, let's do Hotel California again. I mean, can you fucking imagine what, like, having to dredge that up after all these decades?
Sure, yeah. It's, I you know, I mean, to have, it would be, all I could say is, yes, that must be really difficult, and it would also be nice to have written Hotel California and to have people, you know, want really badly to hear it, but, you know, you never know. I mean, I think that you also raise a good point about saying things over and over again. You know, I don't know who it was. It was either an acting teacher or an actor or a director or somebody, you know, gave the example of you're doing the dinner scene in the play, and there used to be a laugh on Pass the Salt. And all of a sudden, the audience stops laughing on Pass the Salt. And you start to freak out because you can't figure out what happened. Is someone distracting you, or is my leg like moving in a weird way, or what's the timing, or, you know, how come I'm not getting the laugh on that anymore? And the director says, well, it's because you're no longer wanting the salt. You know, it's like all you're doing is saying pass the salt, but you've forgotten that you actually want the salt, that you want. And it's like such a mind fuck, because like you really go, well, shit, that's true. And that this has happened to me. And then on the next night, you actually ask for the salt again. You know, you actually look at the actor in the eye and you ask for it. And miraculously, they're laughing. You know, it's a very bizarre thing. I can't really put my finger on it.
I think people can sense authenticity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they can read it, and I also think it's a good. I also think it's an interesting thing to take into life too. When you in relationships or jobs that you've had for a long time, just the sort of when you go in by rote and you're just repeating the same syllables over and over again, and it doesn't have the same meaning. It's like that's when you do have to go in and create a new experience, form a new neural pathway, or put yourself in a little bit of danger to try to make it fun and exciting again. I don't think that's just for stage or performance. I think you have to do that in life, and it sucks because it feels like work sometimes, but I think it's necessary.
Yeah, I do think sometimes if I'm doing multiple takes, or if it's a scene that takes a whole lot of coverage, and I start to feel like I've said it so many times, and I'm kind of like losing the intention or the emotion or whatever, I will actually impose something on it that may not be necessarily organic or may not be all that well thought out, but just the imposition of some new way of saying it will wake me up, wake the other actor up, and put us back in the moment. It may not be the take that they use, but and it may not match, you know, but it does have it can have a really like interesting effect. And that's what's interesting about making movies is because I feel like you should do I like to do as much homework as I possibly can because I don't look at the set as a place to discover who the character is, you know. I like to do my research, do my backstory, you know, figure out the voice, look, you know, the whole thing, like get all that shit together before you come to the set. But at the same time, it's nice to keep your heart open to the idea that the muse can just drop in on your shoulder and create something that you never expected. That's what's cool about, you know, the energy of, you know, filmmaking.
Yeah, but and the daunting thing seems to be like, well, we're three takes in and I don't feel that yet.
Sure.
And then you're in your head about it, and I'm saying this as someone who's not an I'm not an actor. I'm guessing with the limited amount of that I've done that it's like three oh, what do I you can't force that, right? You can't how do you shake it loose and you just can't.
Yeah, I don't know that you can.
Have you ever been wrong where you were like, God, I completely fucked this sideways, and then you see it and you go, oh, actually, I was completely wrong. I was fine.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I will drive home or I will lie in bed, you know, in the middle of the night thinking through and going, if I had just what I should have done is this or yeah, it wasn't really about that. And and then sometimes I'm okay with it. Mostly, though, I look at most things, even when I thought they were right, as I should have done something differently. You know, mostly I'm wishing that it had been a little different or slightly disappointed. You know, it's interesting. I started to watch my dailies in a way at a pretty early stage. I think it was like around Footloose. And directors are horrified by the idea of actors watching dailies to the point where a lot of times I will contractualize it because there will be this moment where I say, well, can I see the stuff from yesterday? And people are like, no. They just fucking flip out.
Because they don't want you to take over the movie, right?
It's not that. It's that they think I'm going to somehow alter my performance, or there's a million reasons I'll be judging the work that they're doing too harshly, or I will start to get pissed about my hair or makeup or whatever it is. It's like a million reasons why they don't want you to do it. And, you know, I sort of understand it because I've directed, and it can be a little difficult, you know, when an actor says, look, we have to redo that scene. And you know, like, the scene was great. You know, I'm telling you, you know, we don't have it in the budget to redo that scene. No, it was horrible. We have to, you know, you can get yourself in that situation. It can be pretty difficult. On the other hand, it always feels like incredibly, it can feel very disrespectful. You know, it's like, you've done two movies and this is like my 100th, and you don't want me to see what I shot yesterday
right,
so I could see that like I'm on the right track,
right,
or whatever. So I started to do this because I was fascinated. And the first time I started watching the dailies, it was like, you know, when you first left that outgoing message on your Kodaphone, you know, and you were like horrified, and you're like, oh my God.
I sound like that.
But you multiply that by about 1,000.
Hey, it's Kevin, like, leave a message.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. Because now it's like the way you look and the way you sound and everything, and, you know, all your imperfections and all that kind of stuff is just like right blasting you. And the other piece of it that was weird was what I thought I was doing was not what ended up on the screen. So over time, I started to kind of develop this. It's almost like another language of understanding if this is what I think I want to portray in this moment, this is what I have to do. Sometimes even technically, this is what I have to do in terms of, you know, the way that I am working the camera,
yeah,
or the, and you know, it sounds like it sounds like you're you know, walking too much, too far away from spontaneity, and the spontaneity is the thing that people always like embrace, you know, and think is like the thing that you're ultimately going for. But on the other hand, there is a certain amount of technique to being a film actor, and you can't shy away from the idea that there is technique that you can learn over time. And that those years of watching sometimes torturously take after take after take of things that I had done, you know, in the course of that day, I think were really, really helpful. And it's gotten to the point now where I don't need to, I'm not so concerned about seeing everything, you know, and I don't even like fight all that hard for it if they don't want me to.
Well, it just sounds like science. It just sounds like, well, I need to calibrate because I need to know.
Calibration. That's a very good way to put it. Calibration.
Yeah. It was just like, if you're shooting at something and you keep hitting left, you're like, oh, okay, well, if I do this, it's actually going to give me the result that I need. I mean, it's basically, I don't understand people who don't do that when right. they go, well, I can't ever see anything. I don't mm-hmm. like, but how do you, I guess you just kind of hope that it's working. Or?
I guess so. But you know, the other thing is that one of the basic lessons is this idea of less is more, because you know, when I became an actor, I really wanted to put it up there. I wanted to put it up there. I wanted it to be there. I remember, you know, Barry Levinson in Barry's first directing gig was Diner. And he's, you know, the character I had decided and we had sort of decided was, you know, half in the bag for the entire movie. And I kept really wanting to play him drunker. And Barry, you know, I remember I was doing a scene and he, I think, I don't know if it was in the script or if I just naturally did it, but he said, don't push it. You know, you don't have to be so drunk. And I just dropped one of my gloves. And when I saw that in the movie, you know, that really told the story. You know, and the camera is so much, sees so much farther than the naked eye in terms of, you know, your soul and your emotions and all this stuff underneath the surface that we can't see. If there was a camera sitting here next to me shooting you with, like, you know, 65mm lens, you know, you if we played it back, we would see things that I never in a million years would have noticed in this conversation about you and about, you know, what's going on in your mind and all that kind of stuff. That's the thing that you sort of have to learn how to trust. And the only way to learn how to trust that is by, you know, seeing what you're doing and what's ending up on screen.
Yeah, because most of the time you don't think about how you do things. You just do them. How would you pick, you know, like if someone just said, okay, we're going to do an acting, how would a regular guy pick up that phone and be like, I don't know, like this, or am I supposed to do it like this? Because you just don't think about what you're doing most of the time.
Yeah.
But I think it's a really valuable experience to watch yourself, not for, you know, narcissism reasons, but for reasons of like, I need to know how I'm coming up as an audience member.
Right.
And I need to know if I'm believing the stuff that I'm saying. How would you know that otherwise?
Yeah.
And do you carry that as a director, or do you sort of have an open policy with your actors?
No, hell no. Forget it. It's the last thing you want. It's an actor seeing their dailies. Forget it. Fucking nightmare.
No, Kevin's really cool. That's weird. The door's locked. And I was like, pretty sure he's in there. Let me in. My hair was stupid. Let me in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just all I think so. But Cop Car comes out August 7th in the theaters, and I believe on the 14th on VOD, correct?
Yeah, we're going wider on the 14th. More theaters on the 14th.
Yeah. But it is also – VOD as well. What do you think about the simultaneous VOD theatrical release?
Well, this is the first time I've ever done it, you know. I mean, it's kind of weird because, like, you know, my experience is like, this is like, if you're going to VOD, it's like a disaster.
Right.
You know, it's not something you're actually trying to have happen.
No, it's not. It's not like that anymore. That's where a lot of the audiences are. Like movies, some really great movies just get released on VOD and they have incredible lifespans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, when I actually look back and I think about it, there's movies that I have done, movies like Tremors, movies like
So Good,
The Big Picture, you know, a few movies that were complete bombs at the box office, and they had this life on video. Now, it's not what I wanted because it's, you know, it just wasn't the template for continuing to work. You know what I mean? It wasn't the template to be a, you know, successful actor was to have, you know, stuff on video. But in a case of something like Cop Car, you know, I think it's kind of a cool place. And I know that it's a generational thing in the way that people consume content. And really, if the idea is to have as many people see it as possible, which is the idea, to have people other than my immediate family, you know, see the picture, then I think it's great. You know, it was a little bit of a mindset adjustment to think about, but I think for a movie like this, it's the best possible.
It's just the way people are consuming things now, and I think it is allowing people to see things as more people at the same time. Because, you know, it's harder and harder to get people to leave their houses to do stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, you know, kids, someone recently said, you know, kids used to watch TV and grown-ups went to the movies, and now kids go to movies and grown-ups watch TV.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you can, if you're in a town, for instance, where, you know, there's one multiplex, and in that multiplex you know, all the big summer blockbusters. Why shouldn't we say, well, therefore, they'll never get a chance to see Cop Car? You know, I think it's kind of cool.
By the way, I don't know if I fanned out on you the last time you were on, but The Big Picture is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, cool!
Literally, of all, I've seen that movie probably 100 times.
Yeah, so that's a perfect example, right?
But I saw it in the theater too.
Oh, you did? Oh,
I did.
Good
I went,
for you.
I went
okay.
and saw it in the theater, and I bought it when it came out on home video.
Oh.
And it's a fuck. It's but that's an example of a movie I'm sure that caught on in home video.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Was you know not. I mean, the studio didn't like it and didn't have any kind of hopes for it. Therefore, didn't support it. And you know, it came and went in a weekend.
Oh man, it's even if you have even a slight understanding of the entertainment business,
yeah.
There's a whole layer of jokes that are amazing. But even if you don't,
right.
It's you just get gems. Like the guy who's I'm sorry to do this to you, but it literally is one of my favorite
it's
movies.
Okay, I don't mind talking about it.
But the guy who when you're looking at the apartment, when you start getting seduced by the money and you start looking at this really great apartment, this guy goes. He's showing you the apartment and he mentions a movie and he goes, that was Red Reardon's first picture. I made him a star, a big star. And then he turned around and crapped in my face. Literally. It's just this weird, it's such a non sequitur. Yeah. And it's one of my favorite lines in a movie.
I forgot about that. Yeah, I forgot that scene. I haven't seen the movie in a really long time. But, you know, Christopher Guest is an absolute genius. And it's an interesting movie because although he didn't direct Spinal Tap, you know, Spinal Tap was, you know, very much in line with the mockumentaries that he went on to make one after another, brilliant, you know, Mighty Wind and For Your Consideration and Waiting for Guffman and on and on and on. I mean, every one of them a gem. But right before that, this was his actual, you know, regular narrative kind of film. But at the same time has that painful reality of Hollywood. And to this day, you know, I go into situations that just remind me so much of The Big Picture. And you know, I'll be sitting in a meeting or something, you know, or look over and someone is like saying, I don't know you. I don't know your work, but I think you're really talented. You know, just things like that. Martin Short is just so, so, so great.
Do you
so
like
funny.
Thimbles, Nick? Like, it's just, there's so much weird.
I forgot about that.
And then this weird thimble animation happens, but it's so.
Right.
But it's so much. And also, the message of the movie is so wonderful and sweet. And just, you know, and the basic message is like, just follow your heart. Just follow what you want. Follow your heart. Like, don't get seduced by all the crap. Just do the thing that you care about.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you knew this, but John Watts, who directed Cop Car, it's also one of his favorite movies, The Big Picture. And he is sort of living it now because he went from Cop Car to Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I said to him, you know, you should go back and take another look at the big picture over the next, you know, few years, just as a cautionary tale. But it's, yeah, it was, you know, sure, disappointing, but what, you know, if that movie was made now, that would be a movie that would probably be a good idea to hit VOD, you know?
Yeah. But I don't think, you know, it may have been disappointing in terms of like, well, it was only in the theaters for a weekend, but I do think that the residual effect that movie has had on a generation of people, it's such a, I mean, it, I think it can't be anything but a huge success. It's such a great comedy. And even just watching the Free the Bacon video, I'm like, God, I would love to see Kevin do more comedy stuff.
Oh yeah, too. I'd like to. You know, it's interesting because you go through a career and you know you're trying to, you know, my whole thing was trying to be able to play different kinds of characters. You know, and I have that now. The things that come to me are really pretty. A pretty wide base. I mean, if you look at the guy in Cop Car, he's really different than the guy in Black Mass, for instance. And so it's not like I'm stuck in one thing. But even in my life, I am definitely thought of as a dramatic actor at this point in my career. And to be able to sort of shake that off a little bit would be nice. And you know, it's funny because you don't really know. You say, well, why don't you just tell your agents and they'll get you a comedy? And it doesn't really work that way. You know, I'm sure you know that in the same way the world of comedy has a, you know, it's a little bit of a club. You know, of and certainly these days there is a definite, you know, kind of core film comedy, you know, club. So. Getting, you know, in that or being considered in that kind of way is a little bit of an uphill battle. But that being said, in the meantime, it's fun to do things like the, you know, the Mashable stuff and you know, just keep, for even for my own head, just keep, you know, not being so serious all the time.
Yeah. So just really quick before we let you go, tell everyone just what is Cop Car about? When it comes out,
Cop Car is it's a very small film that feels like a big film. It is a crowd pleasing, edge of your seat thriller about two 10-year-old boys who are kind of running away from home. You get the impression that they're not going to get very far, but they're moving across the plains and. They're probably about moving across the plains. They live on the plains. So they're probably about, you know, a quarter mile or half a mile from their house, but they are running away from home. And they come upon this abandoned cop car and they figure out how to turn it on and they sort of figure out how to drive and they take off. And then you meet the guy whose car it is, and that's me, and I'm the sheriff of the small town. And they took the wrong car. they took the wrong car. That would be the that would be the understatement.
Yeah, and because there's a pretty military haircut to that guy.
He's got a short haircut and a big mustache.
Short haircut, big mustache.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And you had fun. You had fun working on
that. Oh yeah, I had a great time. I loved it. It was really fun. I think the you know, I'm very proud of the movie. I think it's. You know, it's a cool movie because it is very little dialogue, and people have said to me, "Well, how could you tell from the script that it was going to be good when there's so little being said?" But the script was descriptive in kind of a beautiful way, where I felt as though after I'd finished reading it that I'd seen the movie. You know, it really, the writers had this way of like kind of just. I don't know, making the movie clear. And I read it in one sitting, you know, just kind of rifled through it. And I went and looked at a film that John Watts, who directed it, his first film. This is Cop Car, his second film. He had a film called Clown that I screened. It was a horror movie that's never come out. It's fantastic. It's kind of funny, weird, scary. Not exactly in the same... genre is Cop Car because it's a clown is a little bit more of a straight up, you know, horror. But you could see that he had a cool vision.
Two 10-year-olds stumble across the wrong clown car.
Yeah, clown car. but he just has a way of writing something and putting it up there on the screen, and the two kids are fantastic, and I think people are going
to
like it.
Excellent. Well, it's really nice to talk to you again. And
likewise.
It was really, you know, the last time I felt like we were invading your space a little bit because we were literally in your trailer.
That's great.
And
come my trailer anytime you want.
All right. Hey, you said, hey, let me go. As I'm being thrown off the lot. But yeah, anytime you want to come back. And are there any? I went to the Bacon Brothers site and I didn't see any. Are there dates? Are you guys going to tour anytime soon?
We toured. We just finished.
You're just finished.
Yeah, we finished 2 months of really pretty solid touring. So that was great. We just last weekend we did 2 nights in Las Vegas, which is kind of like the last one for a little while. But you know, I mean, I'm sure you've talked to a lot of musicians. You know, it's nice when you tour and things just get tighter and deeper, and you also get to that point where you can kind of start, I don't know, experimenting, having fun, trying new things, you know, throwing new songs in the set and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get to the point where you're comfortable enough with everything that you could do it by muscle memory, that then you can start fucking with the formula
definitely,
a little bit.
Definitely.
That's where it gets fun. And also, I was looking at 6degrees.org, which is an amazing idea.
Yeah, we're doing great with 6degrees.org. One of the things that we're really focusing on now are small grassroots kind of charities. People who don't have big, giant, you know, money and publicity kind of machines behind them, who are also doing good work out there, all kinds of things. And we connect them to celebrities, and celebrities can connect to them, whether they're sports or music or acting or whatever. And actually, we do it a lot with the Bacon Brothers. It's really nicely formatted for being on the road, because we'll come into a town and, you know, have the time before the sound check and do what's called a drop-in and just do and go do something fun and, you know, say hi to people. The whole thing will take maybe, you know, a half an hour. Tweet about it, give some exposure to either small businesses who are giving back to their communities in certain ways, or actual charity, and then just move on down the road. And it's kind of like a win-win, because obviously it's good for these organizations to get exposure that they wouldn't normally have. And from a celebrity standpoint, you know, you feel good about it, and you know, on top of it, it doesn't look bad.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being here.
All right, thank you, man.
And enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.